The door remains open.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This is VOA News via remote. I'm Michael Brown. Experts at the World Health Organization Tuesday acknowledge there is growing evidence the coronavirus can spread through the air and said they are preparing a brief on the subject. The head of the WHO Technical Committee said the UN agency was contacted in April by a group of more than 200 scientists who have called for the body to and others to acknowledge that the coronavirus can spread in the air. Committee is studying the matter. The University of Washington's Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation says if current trends continue, the current coronavirus death toll in the U.S. could reach 208,000 by November. The Institute said if 95% of people wear a mask in public, some 45,000 lives might be saved. The Institute's director, Dr. Christopher Murray, said making masks compulsory could have, in his words, quoting now, huge economic benefits by staving off the need to keep businesses closed. Murray said the United States never experienced what he called a true end to the first wave of the virus, but he said that doesn't mean there won't be a second wave starting around September, when cooler weather allows the virus to live longer and people staying indoors makes it easier for the virus to spread from person to person. Murray said the second wave will hit hardest in states already seeing high rates of infections, including Florida and Texas. And the White House formally notified the United Nations it is pulling out the United States out of the World Health Organization, despite the surging number of COVID-19 cases in the country. This is VOA News. China on Wednesday opened a new office for its security agents to operate openly in Hong Kong for the first time under a tough new law transforming a hotel into the force's headquarters. Beijing imposed a new security law on Hong Kong last week targeting acts of subversion, secession, terrorism, and foreign collusion. The law is the most radical change in Hong Kong's freedoms and autonomy since Britain handed the city back to China back in 1997. President Trump says he is open to another summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, even as Pyongyang signals it is uninterested in resuming stalled nuclear talks. Trump made comments Tuesday in an interview with Gray Television's Greta Van Susteren, when Van Susteren, also a VOA contributor, asked if Trump thought such a meeting would be helpful. Trump replied, quoting again, "Probably. I have a very good relationship with him. Probably would be." North Korea has twice in the past week said it is not interested in more talks with the U.S., insisting another summit would only benefit Trump's domestic political situation. Amid a surge of COVID-19 infections, especially among younger people, the White House is pressuring schools across the United States to reopen. President Trump said Tuesday, quoting, "We are very much going to put pressure on governors and everybody else to open the schools, to get them open. It's very important. A significant unknown is whether young children who are efficient transmitters of the influenza virus will spread this coronavirus to older teachers and staff and take the novel coronavirus home to their family members and elderly relatives. Education groups want at least $200 billion in federal funding to safely reopen at a time state coffers have been depleted due to the economic recession caused by the pandemic. Only $13.5 billion has been appropriated so far." Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro says he tested positive for coronavirus a few days after showing symptoms, including a fever. He made the announcement Tuesday. Bolsonaro has previously downplayed the risk posed by the coronavirus, once telling supporters because of his history of athleticism, he would not worry if he became infected. He said, "I would not feel it. It would be like a little flu, like I'm under the weather." Bolsonaro's apparent disregard for the potential lethal effects of the virus has led him to challenge safeguard measures to prevent the spread of the virus. For more news, please join us at voanews.com or the VOA mobile app. Via remote, I'm Michael Brown. VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, July 8th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Kenyan police fired tear gas Tuesday against human rights protesters.
The big demand of the march is just the implementation of the 2010 Constitution, because what people are really seeing is that these rights are actually not being respected or implemented.
Meanwhile, Kenyan schools will reopen in 2021. Liberia's largest public university is going e-learning, but will students afford it? Sierra Leone doctors threaten to expand their strike, and opposition groups in Mali will resume their protest this Friday to demand President Keita's resignation.
We're going to be protesting on Friday, and from Friday we will be keeping a civil disobedience for the rest of the time until he resigns. We'll be occupying all the government buildings in the country. We will do it with no violence.
Dr. Ramata Siseko Sise is the president of the Change in Mali movement, and we'll get reaction to this week's U.S. immigration new policy on foreign students. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Hundreds of demonstrators, mostly from poor parts of Nairobi, marched through the streets on Tuesday of the Kenyan capital to protest against violent policing and the lack of basic services in their areas. Police used tear gas and arrests to block the protesters as they tried to reach the president's office to deliver a petition. Rael Ombuo has the story from Nairobi.
Sabasaba is a Swahili phrase that means 7-7 in English, denoting the date, the 7th of July. It's remembered in Kenya as the day in 1990 when opposition parties attempted to hold a series of nationwide rallies to protest the then one-party state and call for political reforms. Hundreds were arrested and dozens killed as security forces squashed the protests. On July 7, 2020, the 30th anniversary of this protest, hundreds of people marched through the streets of Nairobi to demonstrate against what they describe as social and economic injustices. Most are residents of Mathare, Kiamaiko, and Dandora, some of the poorest parts of Nairobi. Many protesters say the government is depriving them of basic needs, including the right to life. 32-year-old George Muhia, a community organizer from Kiamaiko, a poor neighborhood in Nairobi, was among those hoping to deliver a petition to the president. Muhia said, "What the petition contains is some of the violations that we have documented at social justice centers and the enforced disappearances that have been happening even before COVID. Some of the disappearances happened in January when we lost three of our colleagues from Dandora. After 3 months, three of our colleagues from Kiamaiko, and up to date, we can count at least 15 cases of enforced disappearances." Since January to date, Missing Voices, a coalition of at least a dozen rights groups in Kenya, has documented 100 cases of police killings. Some of these victims, Muhia says, were people known to him. Muhia says the economic situation in Kenya does not allow poor people to access basic things like a good education and job opportunities. Eileen Wanjiku is the research campaigner at Missing Voices.
This year, the big demand of the march is just the implementation of the 2010 Constitution. Because what people are really seeing is that, especially when it comes to, you know, the implementation of Article 43, this is like right to water, right to house. These rights are actually not being respected or implemented by the government. And then there's also the big one, which is, you know, the right to life. So we're also seeing that this one, it's been disrespected, I think, in so many different ways. So, for example, you have violent policing. So you have a lot of people who are actually dying at the hands of, you know, police officers.
Police used tear gas to break up the march Tuesday, and they arrested more than 50 people. The protesters were unable to reach the president's office to deliver their petition. Rael Umbur for VOA News, Nairobi.
Learning institutions in Kenya for primary and high schools will reopen in January 2021. Ministry of Education Cabinet Secretary George Magoha said the schools will only reopen when the COVID-19 curve flattens. As Marie Ojiambo reports from Nairobi, students who were preparing for the Kenya national examinations will sit for the exams next year, as all students will be required to repeat their current classes.
The Kenya school calendar has been considered lost for the year 2020 as a result of COVID-19. Kenya's Education Cabinet Secretary George Magoha said that all schools in the country will reopen in January 2021. and that the 2020 national examination candidates will sit for their exams towards the end of the year 2021.
These stakeholders have resolved to reopen all basic institutions in January. This is based on the assumption that the curve will have flattened, or we shall have known a little bit much more about this virus. The implications of these resolutions are that, one, there shall be no KCPE for the year 2020. The 2020 standard 8 and from 4 cohorts will sit their examinations later in the year of 2021. The school calendar of this year will be considered lost due to COVID-19.
The higher learning institutions will have to embrace virtual learning, as most tertiary institutions and universities are required to follow Ministry of Health guidelines before they resume learning in September this year. Mr. Magoha said that universities and colleges that will not meet the required standards set by the Ministry of Health will not be allowed to operate.
Teacher training colleges and TVET institutions will be allowed to reopen from September, subject to very strict adherence to COVID-19 protocols. And you may ask why. These institutions, if they have good managers, can regulate the numbers in their presence. Those who are not able to regulate, again, this will be on a case-by-case basis, shall remain closed. All decisions that we have made here with stakeholders regarding reopening of learning institutions may change, as informed by dynamic reports from the Ministry of Health.
According to the Ministry of Education, over 90% of parents want their children not to go back to school until COVID-19 is contained in the country. Judy Kea is a high school parent. She says the change of school calendar is a good cause to prevent students from the deadly virus. However, she raises concerns that the government should address the issue of school fees most parents had paid for the year 2020.
We are not even sure that school is really going to open in January. But now, since it's already happening, it's already here with us. So meanwhile, the school fees that you'd already paid, no one is telling us whether we'll be refunded or what is going to happen. But what you are praying is that whatever money we paid, because it hadn't been utilized. So we pray that carry forward the school fees that you'd already paid. So we continue from there.
Schools in Kenya were closed in mid-March after few corona cases were recorded in the country, and students will have to wait for 6 more months to resume classes from where they left. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, July 8th. The University of Liberia, the country's largest public institution of higher learning, says it is migrating from normal learning to an e-learning platform. University President Julius Nelson said the decision is based on the fact that the university is not too certain when there will be an end to the current coronavirus pandemic. The migration to e-learning comes at a time when there are economic challenges and technological gaps facing many students and lecturers at the university. Moses Garcia will report from Monrovia.
It appears that this might be the most ambitious but not impossible undertaking by the state-run university. Opened in 1862, the University of Liberia stands as one of Africa's oldest tertiary institutions, but it has not fully migrated to the digital age. University President Julius Nelson says the coronavirus and respect for social distancing is the reason for rolling out early this future plan.
I say, well, I've been listening to all the international media, WHO, and nobody right now have a hand on when it will be over with. So we put aside that option. The next option was to do a blended option for we to do 40% online and 60% face-to-face of our students being on campus. 60% of our student enrollment being on campus is also a nightmare.
Most faculty members are challenged by the technology age, but Dr. Nelson says the university has been preparing those who called born before the computer age.
Our faculty members were at the far end of the being prepared for the technology gap, because as we usually describe ourselves, we were born before the computer. But the intensive 8 weeks of training that we are still continuing helped to close that gap.
Students will also have difficulties adapting to new web portal system, let alone learning their academic lessons. Darren Watkins is the university vice president responsible for information communication and technology.
It's easier to adapt, but that is globally supported and that was cheaper. We didn't want want the students to struggle. We knew that some students, this is the first time for a lot of our students. So we found a user-friendly and globally supported option. And Moodle is a free and open source e-learning management system that is being used by over 175 million learners.
The parents of most students at the University of Liberia earn very little income as such. The students survive largely on scholarship and the government's current free education. Some observers say migrating to an e-learning program might be burdensome for some students, especially with the high cost of internet packages and other economic challenges. But Dr. Watkins says GSM companies have agreed to lower internet costs for students that will participate in the online learning process.
And then we went to the GSM companies, and they were willing and said, okay, we can help with internet connectivity at affordable prices because we too have our own costs to worry about.
Luther Jekyll runs an innovative campus called iCampus, which provides a co-working space for students with interest in technology. Jekyll says in order for the new plan to work, the university must take into consideration prevailing situations in the country.
The economic condition of Liberia, where we have less than 10% of the population having access to stable electricity, backbone water, and internet infrastructure. So there are a lot of factors to look at and how we can tackle these factors that will enable the e-learning platform launched by the State University to be fully utilized.
Daniel Sando, a graduate student at the University of Liberia, says e-learning should be restricted at the master level.
Maybe you can limit that e-learning program to the graduate study for now, but I think to have it be, I mean, set up across the entire university where students who are doing undergraduate will have to be, will have to feel the constraint of going online. But look at our country, for example. I mean, how many percent of the population have access to electricity?
Why the migration to e-learning could enhance the University of Liberia's image and help it meet international best standards, it remains to be seen how the students will handle perceived challenges such as access to computers and other devices, reliable internet, and overall economic problems. Moses Gazio, VOA News, Monrovia.
Opposition and pro-democracy groups in Mali say they will resume their protests this Friday to force the resignation of President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita because they say he failed to meet their demands. Dr. Ramata Sisiko Sise, president of the Change in Mali movement, said the protest will take the form of a peaceful civil disobedience, including occupation of all government buildings throughout the country. President Keita had begun negotiating with the protesters, but Dr. Sisiko says the protesters want to negotiate directly with the president and not with the ruling party, as the president has suggested.
We have been protesting for months against the government because of all the electoral fraud that happened during the election. We don't believe he has been elected. Since then, he has invited the opposition leaders for a meeting, and at the meeting, he requested them to go meet with the governing party. We believe that we need to talk to him. We're not here to talk to the governing parties. We want to talk to him so that he can step down.
As you mentioned, this series of protests in which the opposition made a number of key demands, including that President Keita should step down. But then we heard that the opposition dropped their key demand for the president to step down. Is this true?
Well, we call it a technical way to step down because we proposed to him that he would not name anybody on the top level of the government, that the opposition will be naming everybody, including the prime minister, who will have the full power to run the country. He will have just a honorific title as a president with no power.
Is the president receptive to your proposals?
Well, we thought that he was going to accept it because we believe that's the best way for the country. But he sent us to the majority party to discuss with the majority party. And we are not willing to do that. We want to talk to him directly. We're not going to talk to anybody else who's the one in the country already.
We understand part of your demand was to replace the National Assembly with a transitional legislative assembly.
Yes, because we believe that the election that happened was fraudulent. Most people in the assembly are not representative of the people. So we don't believe in the electoral system they impose on people by corrupting, by using the government money to buy voices and stuff. And the election was not transparent at all. and there were frauds everywhere. So we don't recognize the assembler, we don't recognize him as being representative of the people of the country.
Did you also say that you wanted a government of national unity? Because that, I think, was the original recommendation of the ECOWAS delegation. In fact, if that's the case, you are telling him to step down, not to be president.
Well, we didn't ask for a government of national unity. The ECOWAS proposed that we propose a transitional government designed and represented only by us, because we don't believe in the way they're running the country, unless people who are in the inside can side with us, because they are with him. You must remember that we did a lot of surveys, and 90% of people think he should step down, and about 75% of people think he was not elected. So we don't recognize him as the president in the first place. So when we asked that we need to name the prime minister who will name the government, we didn't talk about the national unity as ECOWAS proposed, because the national unity will include him, and we believe he should not have his say in the new government.
So what's next? Are you going to return to protest?
Now that he refused to talk to us because he sent us to the majority of the party, we want him to step down. We're going to be protesting on Friday, and from Friday we will be keeping a civil disobedience for the rest of the time until he resigns. We'll be occupying all the government buildings in the country, including the national newspapers or any government entity will be occupied by the people until he resigns. We will do it with no violence. It will be peaceful. It will be civil disobedience until he resigns. And we are determined to do that.
Dr. Ramata Sisiko Sise is president of the Change in Mali movement. She was speaking with us from Lawrenceville, Georgia. Doctors in Sierra Leone say they will expand their strike to include treatment for general patients if the government does not meet their demands. The doctors went on strike last Thursday, refusing to treat COVID-19 patients to demand payment of their bonuses and more protective equipment. Sierra Leone government officials did not immediately respond to our request for an interview. Sierra Leone has registered more than 1,000 COVID-19 cases, including 60 deaths. Dr. Delwyn Findlay is president of the Sierra Leone Medical and Dental Association. He said the doctors care about their patients, but now the ball is in the government's court.
The strike with doctors in Sierra Leone is still continuing. We had a meeting of doctors that was yesterday, and the decision came up that we should continue the strike. We will also continue engagement with the authorities that be. We gave a timeline to continue this engagement with the authorities till Friday, after which we'll have another meeting and we'll give updates, and we're going to take our next steps.
You said you plan to expand the strike to cover what?
If by the timeline that we have till Friday, we haven't achieved much and we have a meeting, there are other options open that the strike could be extended even to the non-COVID services, because the others, even our colleagues in hospital, are much more exposed, because if the isolation units and that sort of thing isn't working, that everybody goes into the general clinics. And this morning we just lost another doctor to COVID. So we may extend it to even the non-COVID services to make sure that with the increased exposure, we don't get more of our colleagues contracting COVID and passing away.
So we talked the last time, Dr. Findlay. My question was about the patients.
Yes, we spoke about that. It is very simple. If the authorities could resolve this, everybody could go back to work. It's a very simple alternative. We also think of our patients. In fact, what has been going on, which is not being said to the world, even within the treatment and isolation centers, when there's no equipment or drugs, doctors, even from their own pockets, buy medications for the patients. Mostly they depend on donations for equipment and that sort of thing. And these are all the things that we're talking about.
Dr. Delwyn Findlay is the president of the Sierra Leone Medical and Dental Association. He was speaking with us from the capital of Freetown. The U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, also known as ICE, announced this week that foreign students attending U.S. colleges and universities that will operate entirely online beginning this fall semester cannot remain in the United States to take online classes. ICE says active students currently in the United States enrolled in such programs must depart the United States or take other measures in order to remain in lawful status, such as transferring to a school with in-person instruction. Atem Malak, a former international student, says the policy places an undue burden on foreign students for reasons that they are not responsible for. He hopes ICE will reconsider its decision.
It is very disturbing. I feel bad for international students that are going to be affected by it as a result of COVID. And it's not their fault at all that they're in this situation. So I am absolutely disturbed by what I read. And I hope that the administration will somehow rethink their position on that.
Well, ICE says that the students who might be caught in this process may have two choices. Either they can reduce their course load or they can seek appropriate medical leave. What would that mean for, say, an international student?
Well, it's going to be a little bit difficult for a student because international students are not the same, right? We come from different countries. Some countries are more equipped with, like, internet accessibility and other things that might make it possible for people to do the online classes if they were to go back to their countries. But there are others that come from conflict-torn areas that will absolutely not have any chance to continue with their classes. Also, additionally, if they were to reduce their classes load, they will not be able to finish at a certain number of years. And some of these students come on scholarship as opposed to staying a certain number of years in the U.S. And so it's not going to be good for international students. And that's why I think the ICE should leave those arrangements to the schools, that the school decide what they want to do with the student and the parent and the funding organization that is sponsoring the international student for the case of those who came on the fellowship programs. But for those that are sponsored by their own parent, they should leave that to the schools and the parent to decide what is appropriate.
There are already international students here who are on student visas because their schools have already said they are going to do online education. So what would that mean for their visas?
It sounds like, and this is what I've read so far, it sounds like if they are doing online classes, there's a sentiment that they should not stay in the U.S. soil, right?
Yes.
They should do the online classes anywhere they can do online classes, including being sent home. My concern is that a lot of these students do not come from countries where there is, like, internet accessibility, right? So if you send them to their countries, where are they going to study? Also, if there is, like, a turmoil in that country, where are they going to live? That's why I feel like it's the timing of this, in time of crisis like COVID, it's not good for ICE to impose such kind of rules or suggest that the students should go back to their countries or do classes online. If they are doing classes online in the U.S., that's fine. If that's the arrangement that the schools are going to do in the fall. But to send these students to their respective countries, even those who don't have access to good internet, it's not going to be good for them, for their education.
Atem, thank you very much. It's so nice to talk with you.
Thank you, Matt.
Atem Malak is a former international student in the United States. He was speaking with us from Washington, D.C. And that's it for this Wednesday, July 8th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, hoping that you will have a great day.
VOA's Our Voices television program is about more than just sitting and talking about women's issues. It's about listening to them and bringing their opinions to the table and making sure that their voices are heard. Because our lived experiences, our stories, and our voices will help shape the next generation. Check your local TV listings and join the conversation each week with Our Voices on VOA.
Border Crossings, the Voice of America's Request Hour, brings you an hour of great music and an escape from the news headlines, which aren't too good every single day. Tune in at 1500 Universal to Border Crossing. Make your requests by calling 202-619-2077, and we'll forget about all of our troubles and enjoy an hour of great music. Tune us in, Border Crossings, on the Voice of America.